It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Iran nuclear talks extended yet another day. Negotiators for six world powers in Iran indicated they plan to meet again in Switzerland Thursday, extending framework nuclear negotiations beyond a midnight Tuesday deadline. Mohammad Javad Zarif is the Iranian foreign minister.
We hope that the political will by all parties exists in order to move forward. There are obviously problems that have prevented us from reaching the first stage, finding the solution. And I certainly hope that our colleagues will recognize the fact that this is a unique opportunity that will not be repeated, and they need to take advantage of this opportunity.
Iran reportedly insists on having an outline in place for lifting all international sanctions against Tehran before it agrees to any deal. President Obama has congratulated Nigeria's president-elect Muhammadu Buhari winning the country's election, urging him and defeated incumbent Goodluck Jonathan to work together to unify the country. Mr. Obama pledged U.S. support. Mr. Buhari earlier told a gathering in Abuja that he'll be the leader of all the people.
You are all my people, and I shall treat every one of you as my own. I shall work for those who voted for me, as well as those who voted against me, and even for those who did not vote at all. We all live under one name. As one nation, we are all Nigerians.
Mr. Buhari winning a convincing victory Saturday, beating Mr. Jonathan by more than 2.5 million votes. Nigeria has yet another round of state-level elections scheduled April 11th. This is VOA News. UN Human Rights Chief Zayd Raad Al Hussein told the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva Wednesday Boko Haram must be held to account for the death and widespread destruction it has caused throughout the northeastern Nigerian region.
This despicable and wanton carnage, which constitutes a clear and urgent menace for development, peace, and security, must be stopped. Boko Haram's leaders must know that they will be held accountable in a court of law for these appalling violations of human rights.
He says the Islamist insurgent group is blamed for at least 15,000 deaths, mostly in northeast Nigeria, over the past 6 years. Gunmen Thursday attacked Kenya's Garissa University in the eastern part of the country near the Somali border. Security forces on campus are engaging in gunfire with the attackers. At least two policemen and one student have reportedly been wounded in an attack suspected of being the work of the Somali-based Al-Shabaab militant group. Sierra Leone reportedly has found 10 new Ebola cases during the past week's three-day national lockdown, trying to stem the spread of the deadly virus. Hundreds of sick people were identified by health teams going door-to-door. The head of the country's Ebola response, Alfred Paulo Conte, says since so few cases were found this time, the disease has been conquered and the country is at the what he called tail end of this epidemic. An explosion at a dairy in western Yemen killed at least 35 people Wednesday. There were conflicting reports on whether to blame Saudi-led airstrikes or anti-government fighters. The week-long Saudi-led bombing campaign is intended to stop Iranian-backed Houthi rebels who control Sana'a, the capital, and have advanced southward on Yemen's main port city of Aden. Saudi Brigadier General Ahmed Azari, a coalition spokesman, insisted Wednesday the Houthis are in retreat.
They have no supply coming from out of Aden, actually. The forces was heading Aden. Now they are in retreat toward Dhala and toward Shabwa. We continue to work to make sure that Aden will be clear soon and safe for the legitimate government.
Yemen's foreign minister has called for the Saudi-led military coalition to send troops into the country. Turkish security forces shot a woman dead and detained a man Wednesday after they attacked Istanbul's police headquarters. Two policemen were reportedly wounded when the attackers opened fire on police stationed at the entrance of the building in Istanbul. Germany Chancellor Angela Merkel says the situation in Ukraine has been calm in the past few weeks following the Minsk agreement, but that the ceasefire has not yet been fully implemented. Crimea's independent Tatar language station ATR went off the air Wednesday after Russian authorities refused to give it a broadcasting license. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Thursday, the second day of April, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Is there a lesson in General Buhari's victory for opposition parties in Africa's 2015 upcoming elections?
Retired General Muhammadu Buhari, I think, won the election not only on the issues that he raised during the campaign, but he also won it by very carefully putting together a coalition that transcended the usual ethnic and regional divides of Nigerian politics.
J. Peter Pham is the director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center here in Washington. The Congo government says it is putting pressure on the FDLR Hutu rebels. There were reports of renewed fighting yesterday in South Sudan's Upper Nile State. Amnesty International calls on Gambia to commute the death sentences imposed on three soldiers.
The main objection we have is that the trial was held in secret. So it's very difficult for us to know whether they received a fair trial, whether they were able to properly defend themselves, whether they were able to defend themselves against the evidence that was put forward.
Stephen Cockburn is the Amnesty International Deputy Regional Director for West and Central Africa. And Zimbabwe's constitutional court dismisses challenges raised by expelled ZANU-PF members' parliament. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's post and our list of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An Africa expert says the victory of opposition leader Muhammadu Buhari in Nigeria's March 28 presidential election is a milestone not just for Nigeria, but for the whole continent, where elections are scheduled to be held this year in several African countries. J. Peter Pham, director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, says General Buhari won the election not only on the issues he raised during the campaign, but also by putting together a coalition that transcended the usual ethnic and regional divide of Nigerian politics. Appearing on VOA's Press Conference USA with host Carol Castile and me, Pham said the lesson for African opposition parties is that if they contest election in separate parties, then the dominant or ruling party will always win. But if they unite, they stand a chance of defeating the ruling party.
Retired General Muhammadu Buhari, I think, won the election not only on the issues that he raised during the campaign, but he also won it by very carefully putting together a coalition that transcended the usual ethnic and regional divides of Nigerian politics, bringing into it several parties that had run independent campaigns in the past, including, I think, pivotally, the Action Congress of Nigeria, which polled very strongly last time around, 2011, in southwestern Nigeria.
And would you say that this was a vote really for Buhari as much as it was a vote against Goodluck Jonathan?
Rather than a vote for or against, I would say it was a vote for change. The People's Democratic Party, the PDP, has governed Nigeria through three presidents since 1999 when the military handed power back to civilians. Literally, a good number of the voters had never known any other party in power except the PDP. So there was a desire for change. But certainly there was that also that element of strong support for Buhari, especially in the north, where he had run three times before for president. This was the fourth run he succeeded. And then there was in the south a lot of frustration, especially in the southwest, against the Goodluck Jonathan administration for perhaps failing to deliver on all the promises of 4 years ago.
Let me turn to my colleague James for a question.
You mentioned the coalition that was put together by the Buhari camp. How do you think he can sustain that?
The easy part is over, so to speak, winning the election. Certainly it was a tribute to him and his campaign organization that he did win this election. But now it's a disparate coalition of regional interests, former PDP governors and other officials who had grown disaffected with their own party and defected from the party. So very different interests with different needs that will have to be kept together, not only with positions in the federal government, the executive branch, but also they've won the majority in the Senate and the House of Representatives, but keeping this coalition together is going to be a tough task for the next 4 years.
And you wrote an article right after the election in the U.S. News and World Report, Nigeria Votes, Africa Wins. And you said here that the winner will not only have to finish up the battle with Boko Haram. Has Muhammadu Buhari articulated a plan to finish up the battle against Boko Haram? How different will he approach the insurgency than his predecessor?
The issue with General Buhari And this is to be fair to him, he was running as a challenger, and a challenger in any political competition the world over has the easy job of complaining about how the incumbent has not done things well. And so you attack the incumbent's performance, and you don't necessarily articulate a detailed program because that's not your role as a challenger. So to be fair to him, he didn't do it. It wouldn't have served his political interest to do so. But now he has to govern. And so one either hopes that he has a plan that he simply did not choose to unveil during the course of the campaign, or he and his team very quickly come up with one, because that's going to be needed.
I mentioned the huge number of elections coming up in Africa for this year. What do you think other countries can draw from the Nigeria experience, particularly the experience of Buhari using his coalition?
Well, I think the key lesson is that although there were quite a number of other very minor candidates, none of whom polled even 1% in this election, the fact is the opposition elements in Nigeria coalesced, the two largest ones, and then several medium-sized ones coalesced into one party. It's unity. If you run in separate parties, the predominant party will always win. But if you unite, you have a better chance. So first, overcome your divisions and unite.
J. Peter Pham is director of the Alante Council's Africa Center here in Washington. He spoke with me and Carol Castile, host of VOA's Press Conference USA, which airs this weekend. Amnesty International has called on President Yahya Jammeh of the Gambia to commute to terms of imprisonment the death sentences imposed on soldiers accused of participating in last December's attempted coup d'etat. A military court imposed the death sentences on three soldiers and life imprisonment for three others following a trial on March 30, 2015. Stephen Cockburn is Amnesty International Deputy Regional Director for West and Central Africa. He says Amnesty is deeply concerned about the fairness of the trial, given that it was held in secret and because Gambia's justice system is deeply flawed.
In general, Amnesty opposes the death sentence in all circumstances around the world. We think it's neither a just and fair sentence nor an effective sentence in reducing criminality. And we've long campaigned against the use of death sentence because it violates the right to life, but also because it can lead to injustices that can never be corrected.
Gambia said these people attempted to overthrow the government and that they were tried. Do you have any objection to the manner in which they were put on trial?
The main objection we have is that the trial was held in secret. So there was no observers allowed to the trial. So it's very difficult for us to know whether they received a fair trial, whether they're able to properly defend themselves, whether they were able to defend themselves against the evidence that was put forward. It's very difficult when it's done in such an opaque manner to be able to make a judgment. So Amnesty has a point of view that, first of all, a fair trial needs to be done in the open. It needs to be, people need to have access to their lawyers. They need to have the presumption of innocence. And of course, if they were to be found guilty, Amnesty also opposes the use of the death sentence because it's an unjust punishment. If, of course, someone was found guilty of a crime, they should be punished, of course. But it needs to be done in a fair way without recourse to the death penalty.
You mentioned in your press release the death sentences imposed on Monday are the latest in the series of regressive actions by the Gambian authorities in relation to human rights violations. What do you mean by that?
So Gambia is a country that's long had a very negative human rights context. There are laws and practices in the country where political opponents and journalists are put in prison or made to flee. There is a widespread use of torture in the justice system. It's a very close climate. It's a climate of fear within the country. And what we've seen over the last sort of 3-4 months has been a further deterioration of the human rights situation in the country. So there was, after the coup d'etat, the failed coup d'etat in December, there was at least 30 people arrested and detained without charge, without access to their lawyers, just because they were members of the family of people who were accused of being involved in the coup d'etat. It's a country with a very difficult human rights record. They most recently refused to attend a UN review meeting on their human rights record. Show very little willingness to improve at the moment.
Amnesty International is calling for the death sentences to be commuted. Have you made any representation with the Gambian government?
We will be in touch with the Gambian government. We learned about these sentences first yesterday, and then we're collecting the information together. One of the problems, of course, we do communicate with the government. One of the problems that we have is that the system is so closed and so opaque that it's often very difficult to engage with the government on some of these issues.
Stephen Cockburn is Amnesty International Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa. He was speaking with me from Dakar, Senegal. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, the second day of April, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 and a half minutes past the hour. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, it has been a month since government forces launched a long-awaited offensive against FDLR rebels in the east of the country. Nick Long traveled through the affected zones and sent this report on the status of the operation.
Congolese Army spokesman General Leon Richard Kasonga said during the weekend the FDLR Rwandan rebel movement, whose presence in Congo dates back nearly 20 years, has been driven out of parts of North and South Kivu provinces. The general cited 24 localities and said the Congolese army has captured all its military objectives according to the initial plan. The DRC foreign minister said last week the army is continuing to pursue the FDLR in the forests of eastern Congo. A health worker at Kibirizi, on the edge of the vast Virunga forest where many of the FDLR are hiding, told VOA there has been fighting nearby, and one place General Kasonga mentioned, Kahumiro, is still off limits to civilians. He says there has been a lot of shooting and he does not know if the FDLR has been dispersed, but there is still insecurity in the forest and on certain roads. Around Kiwanja, another town inside the zone of operations, the offensive has had limited impact, according to a local spokesman for the ethnic Hutu community, Jason Ntawiha. He says there has not been as much impact as people expected. They had hoped, he says, the rebels would be completely neutralized, but instead the operation appears to have stalled. They have found rebels are still occupying the positions they were in before, and there has been an upsurge in kidnappings and banditry. The FDLR is only one of about 30 armed groups active in eastern Congo. Although it may be the strongest, and Ntawiha is concerned, the other armed groups have not been targeted by the offensive. In some areas that VOA visited, the FDLR are still visibly in control, for example near Kanyabayonga in Lubero territory. The FDLR did not want to give interviews or pose for photos, but they allowed us to pass through and talk to the population. Here is one of them greeting our driver in the pouring rain. During that friendly greeting, we learned that the local FDLR commander was having a drink in a bar just a few yards away. At the village of Birunduli, a local official said he had to collaborate with the FDLR, and a local chief said the rebels were taxing the population, but otherwise not causing trouble. A villager speaking anonymously told VOA the FDLR is causing trouble elsewhere. He confirms what VOA had heard, that increasingly the FDLR's tactic is not to loot villages where they are living, but to go and loot villages some distance away. About 50 people from a neighbouring village, FDLR-controlled Buleusa, have fled to Kanyabayonga in the past few weeks. They report the FDLR has replaced the local chief, and about a dozen young men who opposed them have disappeared. On Wednesday, local radio reported the FDLR have killed another 5 people in the same area, including a chief and 2 of his sons. The DRC army is pursuing its offensive alone after the UN mission in Congo refused to participate due to alleged human rights violations by 2 Congolese generals leading the push. Meanwhile, MONUSCO chief Martin Kobler has called for collaboration to restart between the DRC government and the UN mission in the anti-FDLR offensive. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Reports from South Sudan's Upper Nile state say government forces clashed with rebel forces on Wednesday. The SPLM in opposition alleges that government troops launched an attack at Mangok in Longchuk County, east of Malakal. But government says there is no report by commanders in the field on Wednesday. Philip Alu has more on the story from Juba.
Peter Hothquetch, the Minister of Information in Upper Nile State, says he received no reports of fighting in Mangok so far.
But I know the tension has been high in Longchuk County. The rebel movement has been monitored by the government for the last 4 days. So if there is any attacks, we will not be surprised to hear such information.
Dixon Gatluak is the deputy spokesperson for the SPLA in opposition, confirms there is fighting, but says the SPLA in opposition is not involved in these latest clashes.
Yeah, of course, as we speak, there is a fighting that is going on in Malakal town in a certain area called Akoka, and the two warring parties are not our forces. These are not the SPLA in opposition. These are the Shuluk militia fighting with the government.
Gatluak says he is not surprised to hear the Shuluk militia in Malakal are turning against the government, saying it is a long time coming.
Juba regime has been recruiting the children, and at the same time they have been committing atrocities against the local population within the Malakal town. And this has been taking place for so long, and the Shuluk community has been ignoring this since the crisis started. But at the moment, as we speak, they have decided to rebel against the government and they took arms.
Gatluak denies there is any link between the SPLA in opposition and the Shuluk militia in Malakal at the moment. Meanwhile, Quite says there are no reports of fresh fighting either in north or west of Malakal, the capital of Upper Nile State. But he says the eastern territory of the state bordering Ethiopia remains tense. He says Nasser town, which government forces controls, have experienced daily shelling from the opposition forces.
The situation in Nasser is constant. The constant, the rebel constantly bombarded, but very far, they use a artillery bombardment, artillery shell with mortar bombs.
SPLA Army spokesman Colonel Philip Aguirre could not be reached for comment. Defense Minister Kwal Manyang says he has not received any information regarding military activities in Upper Nile State. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Washington.
Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court on Wednesday dismissed an application filed by former Presidential Minister Dedemus Mutasa and former legislator Tamba Muiswa, who were seeking to be reinstated as members of parliament. The two, who were expelled from the ruling ZANU-PF, also wanted to block forthcoming elections in their constituencies. Thomas Chiripasi of VOA Zimbabwe Service has more from Harare.
The full bench of the Constitutional Court heard arguments in this case, in which the two were challenging their expulsion from the House of National Assembly after they were recalled by President Robert Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party. Mutasa and Mliswa's lead attorney, Love Moma Duku, told the court that the Speaker of Parliament, Jacob Mudenda, aired when he expelled the legislators without affording them a chance to be heard. Mutasa has dismissed his expulsion and his colleagues from the party following the ZANU-PF Congress last December, which saw the fall of then-Vice President Joyce Mujuru and several others. They were accused of attempting to topple President Mugabe, an accusation they dismissed as untrue. In today's court proceedings, Mudenda's lawyer, Simplicius Chiambakwe, argued that there was nothing unlawful in the speaker's actions, adding that ZANU-PF would be the ultimate loser if the relief being sought had been granted, because Mutasa and Mliswa had ceased to be ZANU-PF members following their expulsion from the ruling party. Maduku told reporters after the court session that his clients were bound by the court's findings.
We were relying on the Constitution. Our own interpretation of the Constitution had been the kind of arguments we were making, that we believe the Speaker ought to have talked to the person's consent, and that he didn't do that. We believe that was a breach of the Constitution. But the court has a different view, and they are entitled to be the final authority on what the Constitution says.
Chiambakwe said he was happy that the matter had been put to rest.
No, we are very happy, and our clients are very happy, and justice has been done, and the human rights, the no partner to our client, has been upheld by the court.
Meanwhile, President Mugabe has proclaimed June 10th as the date on which by-elections to fill vacancies in the two constituencies would be held. On the same day, by-elections would be held to fill vacancies in parliament created by the expulsion of MDC renewal team members from parliament. The opposition party is currently challenging their expulsion from the Augusta House, and their case would be held on April 14th. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with volleyball. Rwanda Revenue Authority dismissed Cameroon's FAP in straight sets of 25-20, 25-21, and 25-21 at the Africa Women's Volleyball Club Championships in Cairo, Egypt, on Wednesday. Outgoing champions GS Petrolia of Algeria beat Uganda's Vision 25-21, 25-14, and 25-14. In other classification encounters, ARSU of the Seychelles outplayed Botswana's Kutluano 25-20, 25-21, 23 and 25-14, as Cameroon's Inches beat Kenya Commercial Bank 25-22, 25-13 and 25-21. Meanwhile, today Thursday, Tunisia's Carthage play Egypt's El Ahly before Egypt's Sham encounter Kenya Pipeline in semi-final action. Turning to football, FIFA presidential aspirant Ali bin Al Hussein will seek more football development assistance for Africa, Asia and the Caribbean islands if elected head of the World Football Governing Body next month. Al Hussein, who is FIFA Vice President for Asia, made his pledge during a meeting with the Zimbabwe Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa in Harare, Zimbabwe. According to the media in Harare, Al Hussein also pledged to increase the number of slots allocated to Africa at the FIFA World Cup, the world football's flagship event. Currently, 54 African countries compete for 5 slots among 32 teams for the World Cup. Al Hussein's visit to Harare is strategic as Zimbabwe currently holds the chair of the African Union presidency. The African Union works closely with the Confederation of African Football in the development of African football. Al Hussein, who is the Jordan Football Federation president, is among 3 aspirants who are challenging incumbent Sepp Blatter in the FIFA presidential elections on the 29th of May in Zurich, Switzerland. Finally, in motorsports, the KCB Safari Rally will be flagged off in Nairobi, Kenya tomorrow, Friday. The 3-day event is Africa's oldest and toughest motor rally. Top performers accumulate points on the FIA Africa Rally Championship chart. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Hello, Africa. Good morning. This is Samuel Steele calling from Freetown, Sierra. I heard from your Daybreak Africa broadcast a couple of days ago that President Obama will be visiting his ancestral home, Kenya, by the end of July, when will we in Sierra Leone see the First Lady Michelle Obama. I read from a BBC Focus on Africa, July-September 2012 edition in the magazine, and I quote, there have also been strong suggestions that the American First Lady Michelle Obama might have a connection to the country Sierra Leone, given that her grandfather was born in a Gula community on the South Carolina coast. I hope to see her one day. Thank you, Daybreak Africa. It's a mystery from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. U.S. President Barack Obama is urging both the winner and loser in Nigeria's presidential elections to work together to unify the country. Mr. Obama on Wednesday called President-elect Muhammadu Buhari, as well as outgoing President Goodluck Jonathan. He congratulated Mr. Buhari on his victory and praised Mr. Jonathan for peacefully conceding the election. Mr. Obama said the U.S. will continue to support Nigeria as it confronts challenges, including the threat posed by the extremist Boko Haram. That is it for this Thursday, April 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producers David Vandy and Tracy Carter, as well as reporters Peter Clotte and Ricky Stryak, and sports editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers.
find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcast. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOANews.com.